everything I could to stop this. I have pleaded that Okella's death should cancel the arrangement. I have said that I'm happy where I am. I have even put forward our marriage as a bar. And as my regent, Victor could plead that his wishes supersede those of Okella, and that I'm too useful to him to leave the state.
Oh, no. I found myself finally able to speak, though only in a whisper.
Oh, yes,
Eric said bitterly.
I've appealed to Felipe, but I haven't heard from him. Oklahoma is one of the rulers eyeing his throne. He may want to placate her. In the meantime, she calls me every week, offering me a share of her kingdom if I'll come to her.
So, she's met you face to face? My voice was a little stronger.
Yes, he said. She was at the summit in Rhodes to make a deal with the King of Tennessee about a prisoner exchange.
Did I remember her? When I was calmer, I might. There'd been several queens there, and not an ugly one among them. There were 1,000 questions crowding to get out of my head and into my mouth, but I clamped my lips shut. This was not a time to speak, but a time to listen. I believed this arrangement hadn't been his idea, and now I understood what Appius had told me when he was about to die. He told me I'd never keep Eric. He'd died happy about that he'd arranged such an advantageous connection for his beloved son, one that would take Eric away from the lowly human he loved. If he'd been in front of me, I'd have killed Appius again and enjoyed it. In the middle of this brooding, and while Eric was saying everything all over again, a white face peered in the kitchen window. Eric could see from my face that something was behind him, and he whipped around so quickly I didn't see him move. To my relief, the face was familiar. "Let him in," I said, and Eric went to the back door. Bubba was in the kitchen a second later, bending over to kiss my hand.
"Hey, pretty lady,"
he said, beaming at me. Bubba had one of the most recognizable faces in the world, though his heyday had been 50 years before.
"Good to see you,"
I said, and I meant it. Bubba had some bad habits, because he was a bad vampire. He'd been too soaked in drugs when he'd been brought over, and the spark of life had been almost extinct. 2 seconds later, it would have been too late. But a morgue attendant in Memphis, a vampire, had been so overwhelmed at seeing him that he'd brought the king over. Then, vampires had been secret creatures of the night, not on the cover of every other magazine the way they are now. Under the name Bubba, he'd been passed around from kingdom to kingdom, given simple tasks to do to earn his keep, and every now and then, on memorable nights, he wanted to sing. He was very fond of Bill, less attached to Eric, but Bubba understood the protocol well enough to be polite.
"Miss Pam is outside,"
Bubba said, looking sideways at Eric.
"You and Mr. Eric doing okay in here?"
Bless his heart, he suspected Eric was hurting me, and he'd come in to check. Bubba was right. Eric was hurting me, but not physically. I felt as though I were standing on the edge of a cliff, narrowly avoiding taking the step off the edge. I was pretty numb, but that wasn't going to last. At this interesting moment, a knock at the front door announced the arrival of, I hoped, Audrina and Colton, our co-conspirators. I went to the door, the two vampires behind me. Feeling absolutely secure in doing so, I opened the front door. Sure enough, the human couple was standing on the front porch waiting, and each of them was gripped by a dripping, grim Pam. Pam's blonde, straight hair was darker with rain and hanging in rat tails. She looked like she could spit nails.
"Please come in," I said politely. "And you too, Pam?"
After all, it was my house and she was my friend. "We need to put our heads together," I thought of adding, though not literally, when I flashed on the heads of Hod and Kelvin, but Audrina and Colton looked pretty frightened already. It was one thing to talk big in your trailer all alone. It was another thing to meet with desperate and terrifying people in a lonely house out in the woods. As I turned away to lead them to the kitchen, I decided to put out some drinks, a bucket of ice, and maybe a bowl of chips and dip. It was time to get this assassination party started.
I think about other deaths later. Chapter 13. Audrina and Colton obviously couldn't decide what was more amazing, the threat of a sodden and beautiful but menacing Pam, or the ruin of glory that was Bubba. They'd expected Eric, but Bubba was a complete surprise. They were entranced, though I whispered to them on our way through the living room not to call him by his real name. I didn't know if they'd have enough self-control. Luckily for us all, they did. Bubba really, really didn't like being reminded of his past life. He had to be in a remarkable mood to sing. Wait. Ha! Finally, I had a real idea. They all sat around the table, absorbed in figuring out my scheme. I got out the refreshments and pulled up a chair by Bubba. I had a floaty, surrealistic feeling. I simply couldn't think about the crash and burn I just experienced. I had to think about this moment and this purpose. Pam sat behind Eric so they wouldn't meet each other's eyes. They both looked miserable, and it was a look I'd seldom seen either of them wear. It didn't look good on them. I felt somehow guilty about the breach between them, though it certainly wasn't my fault. Or was it? I ran it through my mind. Nope, it wasn't. Eric proposed that he infiltrate his vampires into Vampire's Kiss one night in disguise, and that they wait until the club was about to close and the crowds were thin. Then we would attack, and, of course, kill them all. If Victor hadn't been an employee of Felipe, King of Three States, Eric's scheme would have been workable, though there were some definite weak points. But surely killing a bunch of his vampires would piss off Felipe mightily, and I really couldn't blame him. Audrina had a plan, too, involving discovering Victor's sleeping place and getting him while he was out for the day. Wow, that was fresh and original. However, it was a classic for a reason. Victor would be helpless. Except we don't know where he sleeps, I said, trying to slide the objection in there without sounding snooty.
I do,
Audrina said proudly.
He sleeps in a big stone mansion. It's set back from a parish road between Musgrave and Taunton. There's one lone road in, and that's it. There aren't any trees around the house. It's just grass.
Wow, I was impressed. How'd you track him down?
I know the guy who mows the yard, she said. She grinned at me. Dusty Collincheck. Remember him?
Sure, I said, feeling a stir of interest. Dusty's dad owned a fleet, okay, a small fleet, of lawn tractors and weed eaters. And every summer, a group of Bon Ton High School boys earned their walking around money working for Mr. Collincheck. Dusty was inheriting the lawn mowing empire, sounded like.
He says that the house is almost empty during the day because Victor is paranoid about having anyone come in while he's sleeping. He just has two bodyguards there, Dixie and Dixon Mayhew, and they're some kind of were animals.
I know them, I said. They're were panthers. They're good. The Mayhew twins were tough and professional. They must be strapped for cash to work for a vampire. Now that my sister-in-law was dead and Calvin Norris had married Tanya Grissom, I didn't see many of the were-panthers with any frequency. Calvin didn't come into the bar much, and Jason seemed to see his former in-laws only at the full moon when he became one of them, in a limited way, since he'd been bitten, not born, as a were.
So maybe I could bribe the Mayhews if they're that hard up, Eric said. You wouldn't need to kill them then. Less mess. But you humans would have to do the job since Pam and I will be down for the day.
We'd have to search the house because I bet the Mayhews don't know exactly where he sleeps, I said, though I'm sure they have to have a pretty good idea. The vampire smell alone should help the Tuies zone in on where Victor slept, but it seemed kind of tacky to say that out loud. Pam kind of waved her hand. Eric half turned, catching the motion out of the corner of his eye.
What? He said. Oh, you can speak.
Pam looked relieved. She said,
I think when he leaves the club in the morning would be a good time. His attention is on whoever he's going to feed on, and we might be able to attack then.
These were all pretty straightforward plans, and maybe that was both their strength and their weakness. They were simple. And that meant they were predictable. Eric's plan was the bloodiest, of course. There would certainly be loss of life. Audrina and Colton's plan was the most human, since it depended on a day attack. Pam's was possibly the best, since it was a night attack, but not in a heavily peopled area, though the club exit was so obviously the weakest point that I felt sure whatever vampires Victor used as bodyguards, maybe the toothsome Antonio and Luis, would be extra vigilant at such a moment.
I have a plan, I said. It was like I'd suddenly stood up and unhooked my bra. They all looked at me simultaneously, with a combination of surprise and skepticism. I will say that most of the skepticism came from Audrina and Colton, who hardly knew me. Bubba had been sitting on the high stool beside the counter, sipping a True Blood with an unsatisfied air. He looked pleased when I pointed to him and said, "He's the way." I laid out my idea, trying hard to sound confident, and when I was through, they began trying to poke holes in it. And Bubba was reluctant, at least initially. In the end, Bubba said he would do it if Mr. Bill said it was a good idea. I phoned Bill. He was over in a flash, and the look he gave me when I let him in told me he was enjoying remembering how I looked wrapped in a tablecloth, or even before I'd found the tablecloth. With an effort, I swallowed my confusion and explained everything to him. And after a few embellishments had been added, he agreed. We went over the order of events again and again, trying to allow for every contingency. By 3:30 in the morning, we were all in agreement. I was so tired I was asleep on my feet, and Audrina and Colton were barely able to stifle their yawns. Pam, who'd been stepping out of the room to call Emmanuel periodically, preceded Eric out the door. She was anxious to get to the hospital. Bill and Bubba had departed for Bill's house, where Bubba would spend the day. I was alone with Eric. We looked at each other, both at a loss. I tried to put myself in his place, feel what he must feel, but I simply couldn't do it. I couldn't imagine that, say, my grandmother had decided who I should marry and then passed away, fully expecting me to carry out her wishes. I couldn't imagine that I had to follow directions from beyond the grave, leave my home and go to a new place with people I didn't know, have sex with a stranger, simply because someone else had wanted me to. Even, a little voice said inside me, if the stranger was beautiful and wealthy and politically astute. No, I told myself stoutly, not even then.
Can you put yourself in my place?
Eric asked, chiming in on my thoughts. We knew each other pretty well, without the bond. He took my hand and held it between his cold ones. No, actually I can't, I said as evenly as I could manage. I've been trying, but I'm not used to that sort of long-distance manipulation. Even after death, Appius is controlling you, and I just can't picture myself in that position.
Americans,
Eric said, and I couldn't decide if he said it admiringly or with a mild exasperation. Not just Americans, Eric.
I feel very old.
You are very old-fashioned. He was ancient-fashioned.
I can't ignore a signed document, he said almost angrily. He made an agreement for me, and I was his to order. He created me.
What could I say in the face of such conviction?
I'm so glad he's dead,
I told Eric, not caring that my bitterness was written on my face. Eric looked sad, or at least regretful, but there was nothing else to say. Eric didn't mention spending what was left of the night with me, which was smart on his part. After he left, I began checking all the windows and doors in the house. Since so many people had been in and out that day and night, it seemed a good idea. I wasn't too surprised to see Bill out in the yard when I was locking the kitchen window over the sink. Though he didn't beckon to me, I took my weary self outside.
What has Eric done to you? He said.
I condensed the situation into a few sentences.
What a dilemma,
Bill said, not totally displeased.
So you'd feel the way Eric does?
In an eerie echo, Bill took my hand, just as Eric had earlier.
Not only did Appius already enter negotiations, so there are presumably legal documents on the table, but also, I would have to give my maker's wishes some consideration, as much as I hate to acknowledge that. You have no idea how strong the bond is. The years spent with one's maker are the most important years of a vampire's existence. As loathsome as I found Lorena, I have to admit that she did her best to teach me to be an effective vampire. Looking back on her life now, Judith and I talked about this, of course, Lorena betrayed her own maker, and then had years and years to regret it. The guilt drove her mad, we think.
Well, I was glad Bill and Judith had gotten to talk over fun times in the old days with Mama Lorena, murderess, prostitute, torturer. I couldn't really hold the prostitute part against her, since there hadn't been that many ways for a woman alone to make a living in the old times, even a vampire woman. But the rest, no matter what her circumstances had been, no matter how hard her life before and after her first death, Lorena had been an evil bitch. I pulled my hand away from Bill.
Good night, I said. I'm overdue for bed.
Are you angry with me?
Not exactly, I said. I'm just tired and sad.
I love you,
Bill said helplessly, as if he wished those magic words would heal me, but he knew they wouldn't.
That's what you all keep saying, I answered, but it doesn't seem to get me any happier.
I didn't know if I had a valid point or if I was simply being self-pitying, but it was too late at night, no, too early in the morning, to have the clarity of mind to decide that. A few minutes later, I crawled into my bed in an empty house, and being alone felt pretty damn good. I woke up at noon on Friday with two pressing thoughts. The first was, did Dermot renew my wards? And the second was, oh my God, the baby shower is tomorrow!
After some coffee and pulling on my clothes, I called Hooligans. Belenos answered.
Hi, I said. Can I speak to Dermot? Is he better?
He's well, Belenos said, but he's on his way to your house.
Oh, good. Listen, maybe you'll know this. Did he renew the wards on the house, or am I unprotected?
God forbid you should be with a fairy unprotected,
Belenos said, trying to sound serious.
No double entendres.
Okay,
he said, and I could tell he was flashing that sharp-toothed smile.
I myself put wards around your house, and I assure you they will hold.
Thanks, Belenos, I said, but I wasn't completely happy that someone I trusted as little as Belenos had been in charge of my protection.
You're welcome. Despite your doubts, I don't want anything to happen to you.
That's good to know, I said, keeping all expression out of my voice. Belenos laughed.
If you get too lonely out there in the woods, you can always call me, he said.
I said. Thanks. Was the elf coming on to me? That made no sense. More likely he wanted to eat me, and not in the fun way. Maybe better not to know. I wondered how Dermot was getting here, but not enough to call Belenos again. Reassured that Dermot was returning, I studied my list of shower preparations. I'd asked Maxine Fortenberry to make the punch because hers was famous. I was picking up the cake from the bakery. I didn't have to work today or tomorrow, which meant a big loss in tips, but it was turning out real convenient. So my to-do list was like, today, complete all preparations for the baby shower. Tonight, kill Victor. Tomorrow, guests arrive for shower. In the meantime, like any incipient hostess, I was going to be all about the cleaning. My living room was still below par since the attic stuff had been sitting in it, and I started from the top down. Dust the pictures, then the furniture, then the baseboards, then vacuum. I worked my way down the hall, visiting my bedroom, the guest bedroom, and the hall bathroom. I got a squirt bottle of all-purpose cleaner and attacked the kitchen surfaces. I was about to mop the floors when I saw Dermot in the backyard.
He'd driven back in a battered Chevy Compact. "Where'd you get the car?" I called from the back porch.
"I bought it,"
he said proudly. I hoped he hadn't used fairy enchantment or something. I was scared to ask.
"Let me see your head," I said when he got into the house. I looked at the back of his skull where the gash had been. A thin, white line, that was all.
"Amazing," I said. "How do you feel?"
"Better than I did yesterday. I'm ready to get back to work."
He went into the living room.
"You're cleaning," he said. "Is there a special occasion?"
"Yes," I said, smacking myself on the forehead. "I'm so sorry, I forgot to tell you. I'm giving Tara Durone, a baby shower tomorrow. She's expecting twins, Claude believes. Oh, she got that confirmed."
"Can I come?" he asked.
"It's all right with me," I said, taken aback. Most human guys would rather have their toenails painted than come to such a party.
"You'll be the only man there, but I assume that won't bother you."
"Sounds great,"
he said, smiling that beautiful smile. "You'll have to keep your ears covered and listen to about 1,000,000 comments about how much you look like Jason," I said. "We'll need to explain you."
"Just tell them I'm your great uncle," he said.
For one fun moment, I envisioned doing just that. I had to give it up, though, with some regret.
"You look much too young to be my great uncle, and everyone here knows my family tree, the human part of it," I added hastily. "But I'll think of something."
While I vacuumed, Dermot looked at the big box of pictures and the smaller one of printed material that I hadn't yet had a chance to go over. He seemed fascinated by the pictures.
"We don't use this technology,"
he said. I sat beside him when I'd put the vacuum away. I'd tried to arrange the images in chronological order, but it had been a hasty task, and I was sure I'd have to redo it. The pictures at the front of the box were very old. People sitting in stiff groups, their backs rigid, their faces too. If the backs were labeled, it was in spidery, formal handwriting. Many of the men were bearded or mustached, and they wore hats and ties. The women were confined in long sleeves and skirts, and their posture was amazing. Gradually, as the Stackhouse family rolled along in time, the pictures became less posed, more spontaneous. The clothing morphed along with the attitudes. Color began to tint faces and scenery. Dermot seemed genuinely interested, so I explained the background on some of the more recent snapshots. One was of a very old man holding a baby swathed in pink.
"That's me and one of my great-grandfathers. He died when I was little bitty," I said. "That's him and his wife when they were in their 50s. And this is my grandmother, Adele, and her husband."
"No," Dermot said. "That's my brother, Fintan."
"No, this is my grandfather, Mitchell. Look at him."
"He is your grandfather. Your true grandfather, Fintan."
"How can you tell?"
"He's made himself to look like Adele's husband, but I can tell it's my brother. He was my twin, after all, though we were not identical. Look here at his feet. His feet are smaller than those of the man who married Adele. Fintan was always careless that way."
I spread out all the pictures of grandmother and grandfather Stackhouse. Fintan was in about a third of them. I'd suspected from her letter that Fintan had been around more than she'd realized, but this was just creepy. In every picture of Fintan as Mitchell, he was smiling broadly.
"She didn't know about this for sure," I said.
Dermot looked dubious, and I had to admit to myself that she had suspected. It was there, in her letter.
"He was playing one of his jokes," Dermot said fondly. "Fintan was a great one for jokes."
"But," I hesitated, not sure how to phrase what I wanted to say.
"You get that this was really wrong," I said. "You understand that he was deceiving her on a couple of different levels?"
"She agreed to be lovers with him," Dermot said. "He was very fond of her. What difference does it make?"
"It makes a lot of difference," I said. "If she thought she was with one man when she was with another, that's a huge deception."
But a harmless one, surely. After all, even you agree she loved both men, had sex with both of them willingly. So?
He asked again.
What difference does it make?
I stared at him doubtfully. No matter how she felt about her husband or her lover, I still thought there was a moral issue here. In fact, I knew there was. Dermot didn't seem to be able to discern that. I wondered if my great-grandfather would agree with me or with Dermot. I had a sinking feeling I knew.
I better get back to work, I said with a tight smile. Got to mop the kitchen. You gonna get back to work in the attic?
He nodded enthusiastically.
I love the machinery, he said.
Please close the attic door then, because I've dusted down here and I don't want to have to do that again before tomorrow afternoon.
Sure, Sookie.
Dermot went up the stairs whistling. It was a tune I'd never heard before, which figured. I gathered up the pictures, keeping separate the ones that Dermot had earmarked as featuring his brother. I was considering building a little fire with them. Up in the attic, the sander started up. I looked at the ceiling as if I could see Dermot through the boards. Then I shook myself and went back to work, but in an abstracted and uneasy mood. When I was standing on a stepladder hanging the welcome baby sign from the light fixture, I remembered I had to iron my great-grandmother's tablecloth. I hate ironing, but it had to be done, and better today than tomorrow. When the stepladder was put away, I opened the ironing board, there'd been a built-in one in the previous kitchen, and set to work. The tablecloth was not exactly white anymore. It had aged to ivory. I soon had it smooth and beautiful, and touching it reminded me of high occasions in the past. I'd seen pictures including this very piece of cloth today. It had been on the kitchen table or the old sideboard for Thanksgivings and Christmases and wedding showers and anniversaries. I loved my family, and I loved those memories. I only regretted that there were so few of us to recall them. And I was aware of another truth, another real thing. I realized I really didn't appreciate the fairy sense of fun that had made a lie out of some of those memories. By 3 that afternoon, the house was as close to ready as I could get it. The sideboard was draped with a tablecloth, the paper plates and napkins were out, the plastic forks and spoons. I'd polished the silver nut dish and a little tray for the cheese straws, which I'd made and frozen a couple of weeks before. I ran down my checklist. I was as ready as I could possibly be. If I didn't survive tonight, I was afraid that the baby shower would be a bust. I had to assume that my friends would be too jangled to go ahead with the shower if I got killed. Just in case, I left detailed notes about the location of everything that wasn't already out. I even brought out my present for the babies, matching wicker baskets that could be used as traveling cribs. They were decorated with big gingham bows and packed full of useful stuff. I'd accumulated the items for the gift baskets on sale, bit by bit. Bottles for supplemental feeding, a baby thermometer, a few toys, a few receiving blankets, some picture books, bibs, a package of cloth diapers for use as spit-up rags. It felt strange to think that I might not be around to see the babies grow up. It also felt strange that paying for the shower hadn't been such a financial hardship, thanks to the money in my savings account. Suddenly, I had an amazing idea. That made 2 in 2 days. As soon as I'd worked it out in my head, I was in my car and on my way to town. It felt weird walking into Merlot's on my day off. Sam looked surprised but pleased to see me. He was in his office with a stack of bills in front of him. I put another piece of paper on his desk. He looked at it.
What is this?
He said in a low voice.
You know what it is. Don't you give me that, Sam Merlot. You need money. I've got money. You put this in your account today. You use it to pull the bar through until times are better.
I can't take this, Sookie.
He didn't meet my eyes.
The hell you can't, Sam. Look at me.
Finally, he did.
I'm not kidding. You put it in the bank today, I said. And if anything might happen to me, you can repay my estate within, say, 5 years.
Why would anything happen to you?
Sam's face darkened. Nothing will. I'm just saying.
It's irresponsible to loan money without making arrangements to pay it back. I'm calling my lawyer and telling him all this, and he'll draw up a paper. But right now, right this minute, you go to the bank.
Sam looked away. I could feel the emotion sweeping over him. Truly, it felt wonderful to do something nice for him. He'd done so many nice things for me. He said,
"All right."
I could tell it was hard for him, as it would be for almost any man, but he knew it was the sensible thing to do, and he knew it wasn't charity.
"It's a love offering," I said, grinning at him, "like we took up at church last Sunday." That love offering had been for the missionaries in Uganda, and this one was for Merlot's bar.
"I believe that,"
he said, and met my eyes. I kept my smile, but I began to feel a little self-conscious.
"I have to go get ready," I said.
"What for?"
His reddish eyebrows drew together.
"Tara's baby shower," I said. "It's an old-fashioned gals-only party, so you didn't get invited."
"I'll try to contain my misery," he said.
He didn't move. "Are you getting up to go to the bank?" I asked sweetly.
Yeah, getting up right now."
He did get out of the chair and call down the hall to let the servers know he was running a quick errand. I got in my car at the same time he got in his truck. I don't know about Sam, but I was feeling really good. I did stop by my lawyer's to tell him what I'd done. This would be my human, local lawyer, not Mr. Cataliades, whom, by the way, I hadn't heard from. I swung by Maxine's house to get the punch, thanked her profusely, left her a list of what I was going to do and had done for the shower arrangements, to her puzzlement, and took the frozen containers back to my house to pop in the little chest freezer on my back porch. I had the ginger ale set out on the counter to mix with the frozen juices. I was as prepared as I could be for the baby shower. Now, I had to get ready to kill Victor.
Chapter 14. Sam called me as I was putting on my makeup.
"Hi," I said. "You got the check to the bank, yes?"
"Yes," he said, "since you told me like a million times. No problem there. I'm calling to tell you I just got a very weird phone call from your friend Amelia. She said she was calling me because you wouldn't want to talk to her. She said it was about that thing you found. She looked it up, the Cluvial door."
He sounded it out very carefully.
"Yeah?"
"She didn't want to talk over the phone to me about it, but she said to tell you urgently to check your email. She said you were pretty bad about forgetting to do that. She didn't seem to think you'd answer your phone if you knew from your caller ID that it was her on the phone."
"I'll go look at my email right now."
"Sookie?"
"Yeah?"
"You okay?"
"Almost certainly not."
"Sure, Sam. Thanks for standing in place of the answering machine."
"No problem."
Amelia had certainly figured out how to get my attention. I took the Cluvial door out of the drawer and took it with me to the little desk in the living room where I'd put the computer. Yes, I had a lot of mail. Most of it was junk, but there was one from Amelia, sure enough, and one from Mr. Cataliades that had come 2 days before. Color me surprised. I was so curious, I opened his message first. Though he wasn't brief, he was to the point.
"Miss Stackhouse, I got your message on my answering machine. I have been traveling, so certain individuals cannot find me. I have many friends, but also many enemies. I am watching you closely, but I hope not intrusively. You're the only person I know who has as many enemies as I. I've done the best I can to keep you a step ahead of that hellspawn Sandra Pelt. She's not dead yet, though. Beware. I don't believe you knew that I was a great friend of your grandfather, Fenton. I knew your grandmother, though not well. In fact, I met your father and his sister and your brother Jason, though he will never remember it since he was quite small. So were you when I first saw you. They were all disappointments except you. I think you must have found the Cluvial door, since I plucked the term out of Miss Amelia's head when I saw her at the shop. I don't know where your grandmother hid it, I only know she was given one because I gave it to her. If you have discovered it, I advise you to be very careful about its use. Think once, and twice, and three times before you expend its energy. You can change the world, you know. Any series of events you alter by magic can have unexpected repercussions in history. I'll contact you again when I can, and perhaps stop by to explain more fully. Best wishes for your survival. Desmond Cataliades, attorney at law, your sponsor.
As Pam might say, fuck a zombie.
Mr. Cataliades was indeed my sponsor, the dark stranger who'd visited Gran. What did that mean? And he said he had read Amelia's mind. Was he a telepath, too? Wasn't that quite a coincidence? I had a feeling there was a lot to know about this, and though he'd only warned me about Sandra Pelt and using the Cluviel door, I got the distinct impression he was paving the way for a big, bad talk. I read over the message two more times, hoping to extract some solid piece of information about the Cluviel door from it, but I had to conclude I got zilch. I opened Amelia's email, not without a deep feeling of misgiving and a residue of indignation. Her brain was open for the picking, apparently. Amelia had a lot of information in her head about me and my doings. Though this wasn't exactly her fault, I resolved not to tell her any more secrets.
Sookie, I'm sorry for everything. You know I don't think before I act, and I didn't this time. I just wanted you to be as happy as I am with Bob, I guess, and I didn't think about how you'd feel. I was trying to manage your life. Again, sorry. After we got back home, I did some more research and found the Cluviel door. I guess one of your fairy kin must have been talking about this. There hadn't been one on the Earth for hundreds of years. They're fairy love tokens, and they take a year to make, at least. The Cluviel door gives the beloved one wish. That's why it's so romantic, I guess. The wish has to be personal. It can't be for world peace or an end to hunger or something global like that. But on an individual level, apparently this magic is so potent, it can really change a life in a drastic way. If someone gives a loved one a Cluviel door, it's really a serious gesture. It's not like flowers or candy. It's more on the level of a diamond necklace or a yacht if the jewelry or the boat had magical powers. I don't know why you need to know about fairy love tokens, but if you've seen one, you've seen something amazing. I don't think the Fae can even make them anymore. I hope someday you can forgive me, and maybe then I'll hear the story. Amelia. I ran a finger over the smoothness of this very dangerous object I had, and I shivered. Warning, warning, and some more warning. I sat at the desk for a few more minutes, lost in thought. The more I knew about fairy nature, the less I trusted fairies, period. Including Claude and Dermot, and especially Niall, my great-grandfather. It seemed I was always on the verge of remembering something about him, something really tricky. I shook my head impatiently, not the time to worry about that. Though I'd put off admitting it as long as I could, I had to face unpleasant facts. Mr. Cataliades, through his friendship with my birth grandfather, had had more to do with my life than I'd ever guessed, and he was only revealing that to me now for reasons I couldn't fathom. When I'd met the demon lawyer, he hadn't quivered an eyelash in recognition. It was all tied together somehow, and it all added up to a deep misgiving about my fairy kin. I believed that Claude, Dermot, Fintan, and Niall loved me as much as they could. For Claude, this would be quite a small amount, because he loved himself most of all. But I didn't feel that it was a wholesome love. Though that adjective made me wince and think of Wonder Bread, it was the only one that fit. As a sort of corollary to my increased understanding of fairy nature, I no longer doubted Gran's word. Instead, I believed that Fintan had loved my grandmother Adele more than she'd ever realized. and in fact he'd adored her beyond the bounds of human imagination. He'd been with her much more often than she knew, sometimes taking on the guise of her husband to be in her presence. He'd taken family photos with her. He'd watched her go about her daily business. He'd probably, once, had sex with her while disguised as Mitchell. Where had my real grandfather been while all of this was going on? Had he still been present in his body but unconscious? I hoped not, but I'd never know. I wasn't sure I truly wanted to. Because of Fenton's devotion, he'd given my grandmother a Cluvial door. Perhaps it could have saved her life, but I didn't believe she'd ever thought of using it. Perhaps her faith had precluded sincere belief in the power of a magical object. Gran had stowed her letter of confession and the Cluvial door in the concealed drawer years ago to keep them safe from the prying eyes of the two grandchildren she was raising. I was sure that after she'd hidden the items, that made her feel so guilty, she'd almost forgotten about them. I figured the relief of unburdening herself was so great, she'd quit worrying about the memory altogether. It must have seemed outlandish, contrasted with the daily difficulties of being a widow raising two grandchildren. Maybe, I conjectured, from time to time she thought, I really should tell Sookie where those things are. But of course, she'd always supposed she'd have more time. We always do. I looked down at the smooth object in my hand. I tried to imagine the things I could do with it. It was supposed to grant one wish, a wish for someone you loved. Since I loved Eric, presumably I could wish Victor would die, which would definitely benefit my loved one. It seemed awful to me, using a love token to kill someone, whether or not it benefited Eric. An idea came to me that made my eyes widen. I could take away Hunter's telepathy. He could grow up normal. I could counteract Hadley's unintentional burdensome gift to her abandoned son. That seemed like such a fabulous idea. I was delighted for all of 30 seconds. Then, of course, doubt set in. Was it right to change someone's life that much simply because I could? On the other hand, was it right to let Hunter suffer his way through a difficult childhood? I could change myself. That was so shocking an idea that it almost made me black out. I simply couldn't think about it just now. I had to prepare for Operation Victor. After 30 minutes, I was ready to go. I drove to Fantasia, trying to keep my mind empty and my spirit fierce. Emptying my mind was maybe too easy. I'd learned so much in the past few days that I hardly knew who I was anymore, and that made me pretty angry, so fierce was easy too. I sang along with every song on the radio, and because I have an awful voice, I was glad I was alone. Pam can't sing either. I was thinking about her a lot as I drove, wondering if her Miriam was alive or dead, feeling sorry for my best vampire friend. Pam was so tough and so strong and so ruthless that I hadn't ever considered her more delicate emotions until the past few days. Maybe that was why Eric had chosen Pam when he'd wanted a child. He'd sensed they were kindred spirits. I didn't doubt Eric loved me, just as I knew Pam loved her ailing Miriam. But I didn't know if Eric loved me enough to defy all his maker's arrangements, enough to forego the leap in power and status and income he'd gain as consort of the Queen of Oklahoma. Would Eric enjoy being a Sooner? As I navigated through Shreveport, I wondered if Oklahoma vampires wore cowboy boots and knew all the songs from the musical. I wondered why I was thinking such idiotic thoughts when I should be preparing for a very grim evening, an evening I might not survive. Judging from the parking lot, Fantasia was jam-packed. I went to the employee entrance and knocked, using a special pattern. Maxwell opened the door, looking positively suave in a beautiful summer-weight tan suit. Dark-skinned vampires undergo an interesting change a few decades after they're turned. If they were a very dark shade in life, they become a light brown, sort of a milk chocolate. Those who were lighter-skinned become a sort of creamy ecru. Maxwell Lee hadn't been dead long enough for that, though. He was still one of the darkest men I'd ever seen, the color of ebony, and his mustache was as precise as if he'd shaved with a ruler at hand. We'd never been especially fond of each other, but this evening his smile was almost manic in its cheerfulness.
"Miss Stackhouse, we're so glad you stopped by tonight," he said loudly. "Eric will be pleased to see you looking so tasty."
I take my compliments where I can get them, and tasty wasn't bad. I was wearing a strapless dress in sky blue with a broad white belt and white sandals. I know white shoes are supposed to make your feet look big, but mine aren't, so I didn't care. My hair was down. I felt pretty damn good. I held out a foot so Maxwell could admire my self-administered pedicure, spicy pink carnation.
"Fresh as a daisy," Maxwell said.
He pulled aside his jacket to show me that he was carrying a gun. I gave him big eyes of admiration. Carrying a firearm was not a vampire norm, and it might be a bit unexpected. Colton and Audrina came in on my heels. Audrina had put up her hair with what looked like chopsticks, and she was carrying a large purse, almost as large as mine. Colton was armed, too, because he was wearing a jacket, and on a sultry evening like this one, humans just didn't wear jackets if they could help it. I introduced them to Maxwell, and after a polite exchange, they sauntered down the hall to go out into the club. I found Eric in his office sitting behind the desk. Pam was sitting on it, and Thalia was on the couch. Oh boy, I felt more confident when I saw the tiny ancient Greek vampire. Thalia had been turned so long ago that no trace of humanity remained. She was simply a cold killing machine. She'd reluctantly joined the vampires that came out, but she despised humans with a thoroughness and ferocity that had made her a sort of cult figure. One website had offered $5,000 to the man or woman who could get a picture of Thalia smiling. No one had ever collected, but they could have tonight. She was smiling now. It was creepy as hell.
"He accepted the invitation,"
Eric said without preamble.
"He was uneasy, but he couldn't resist. I told him he was welcome to bring as many of his own people as he wished so that they could share the experience."
"That was the only way to do it," I said.
"I think you're right," Pam said. "I think he'll bring only a few because he'll want to show us how confident he is."
Mustafa Khan knocked on the doorframe. Eric beckoned him in.
"Bill and Bubba are making a stop in the alley two blocks over," he said, barely glancing at the rest of us.
"What for?"
Eric was surprised.
Something about cats."
We all looked away, embarrassed. Bubba's perversion was not anything vampires wanted to talk about.
"But he's cheerful? In a good mood?"
"Yes, Eric. He's happy as a minister on Easter Sunday. Bill took him for a drive in an antique car, then horseback riding, and then to the alley. They should be here right on time. I told Bill I'd call him when Victor arrived."
By then, Fantasia would be closed to the public. Though the happy and free-spending crowd out on the floor didn't know it, tonight, the king of rock and roll would sing again for the Regent of Louisiana. Who could turn down an invitation to such an event? Not fanboy Victor, that was for sure. The cardboard cutout at Vampire's Kiss had been a big clue. Of course, Victor had tried to get Bubba to come to his own club, but I'd known Bubba wouldn't want to go to Vampire's Kiss. He'd want to stay with Bill. And if Bill said Fantasia was the place to be, that was what Bubba would insist on. We sat in silence, though Fantasia is never really silent. We could hear the music from the bar area and the hum of voices. It was almost as if the customers could sense that tonight was a special night, that they all had cause to celebrate, or to have a last hurrah before they perished. Though I felt it put me one step closer to catastrophe, I'd brought the Cluvial door. It was tucked into my belt behind the huge buckle. It pressed into my flesh insistently. Mustafa Khan had taken up a stance against the wall. He was deep into his blade fantasy that night, with dark glasses, a leather jacket, and a great haircut. I wondered where his buddy Warren was. Finally, out of sheer desperation for some conversation, I asked,
"Warren, He's outside the club on the roof of the Bed Bath & Beyond.
Mustafa Khan didn't turn his face to me when he spoke.
What for?
He's a shooter. We refined your idea a bit,
Eric said.
Anyone gets out the door, Warren will take care of them.
He'd been slumped back in his chair with his feet on the desk. Pam hadn't looked at me since I'd come in. Suddenly, I wondered why. Pam, I said. I got up and took a step toward her. She shook her head, her face averted. I can't read vampire minds, but I didn't have to. Miriam had died today. Looking at the set of Pam's shoulders, I knew better than to say anything. It went against my nature to resume my seat on the couch without offering her comfort, a Kleenex, a few words of solace. But it would be Pam's nature to strike out if I offered those things. I touched my belt where the cluvial door made a hard impression on my stomach. Could I wish Miriam back alive? I wondered if that would satisfy the requirement that the wish be for someone I loved. I was very fond of Pam, but wouldn't that be too indirect? I felt like I had a bomb strapped to me. I heard the shimmery sound of the gong. Eric had installed one in the bar, and the bartender rang it 15 minutes before closing. I didn't even know who'd taken over the bartending duties since Felicia had been killed by Alexei. Maybe I hadn't been interested enough in Eric's business lately. On the other hand, he himself had been abstracted from his normal absorption in his little kingdom by Victor's predations. I realized that lack of conversation about ordinary things was one of our problems. I hoped we'd get to correct it. I got up and went down the hall to the main area of the bar. I couldn't stand sitting in Eric's office anymore, not with Pam suffering the way she was. I spotted Colton and Audrina dancing on the tiny floor, arms around each other. Emmanuel was sitting at the bar, and I climbed onto the stool next to him. The bartender came to stand across from me. He was a brawny fellow with ringlets cascading down his back, total eye candy, a vampire, of course.
What can I get you, wife of my sheriff?
He asked ceremoniously.
You can get me a tonic and lime, please. Sorry I haven't had a chance to meet you before. What's your name?
Jock,
he said, as if daring me to make a joke. I wouldn't dream of it.
When did you start work, Jock?
I came from Reno when the last bartender died, he said. I worked for Victor there.
I wondered which way Jock would jump tonight. Interesting to see. I didn't know Emmanuel well. In fact, I barely knew him, but I patted his shoulder and asked him if I could buy him a drink. He turned and gave my hair a long look, finally nodding his approval.
Sure, he said. I'd like another beer.
I'm sorry, I said quietly, after I'd asked Jock to bring Emmanuel a beer. I wondered where Miriam's body was now, at the Undertaker's, I assumed.
Appreciated, he replied.
After a moment, he said,
Pam was going to do it tonight, without permission. Turn Miriam, that is. But Mir just breathed out one last time, and then she was gone.
Your mom and dad? He shook his head.
It was just us.
There was really nothing else to say about that.
Maybe you should go home, I suggested. He didn't look like much of a fighter to me.
I don't think so,
he said. I couldn't make him leave, so I drank my tonic and lime while all the human customers left. The bar grew quiet and relatively empty. Indira, one of Eric's vamps, came in, wearing a full sari. I had never seen her in traditional clothing before, and the pink and green of the pattern was really fetching. Jock gave her an admiring look. Thalia and Maxwell came out of the back and moved around the club along with the human staff, busy cleaning the place up for the after party. I helped too. This was work I was used to. The tables circling the little dance floor and stage were moved away, and two lines of chairs were arranged instead. Maxwell brought in an elaborate sort of boombox, Bubba's music. After I swept the dance floor and stage, I got out of the way by resuming my stool at the bar. Heidi, whose specialty was tracking, came in,
her hair in narrow braids. Lean and plain, Heidi always carried an air of grief around with her like a cloud. I had no idea what she'd do tonight when the shit hit the fan. While Jock was cleaning up the supplies on his side of the counter, Colton and Audrina came over. Jock looked surprised to see humans he didn't know. Their presence had to be explained. I didn't want Jock becoming suspicious. I said, "Colton, Audrina, meet Jock. Jock, these two lovely people have agreed to donate in case Victor wants local hospitality. Of course, we're hoping that won't happen on the premises, but Eric doesn't want to fail in his welcome."
"Good idea,"
Jock said, eyeing Audrina appreciatively.
"We can't give the regent less than he expects."
"No, or less than he deserves." After 45 minutes, the place looked pretty good again, and the last of the human employees went out the back door. The only breathers remaining were Colton, Audrina, Emmanuel, Mustafa Khan, and me. I definitely had that conspicuous feeling. The Shreveport vamps I'd known since I'd started dating Bill had assembled: Pam, Maxwell Lee, Thalia, Indira. I knew all of them to some extent. Victor would be instantly alert if all Eric's vampires were there, or if they were all Eric's heavy hitters. So Eric had called in the little Minden nest, Palomino, Rubio Hermosa, and Parker Coburn, the Katrina exiles. They trailed in looking unhappy but resigned. They stood against the wall, holding hands. It was kind of sweet, but sad, too. The jukebox cut off. The near silence was instantly oppressive. Though Fantasia sits in a busy shopping and dining area of Shreveport, at this hour, even on a weekend, there was not much city sound outside. None of us felt like talking. I didn't know what thoughts occupied other heads, but I was considering the fact that I might die that very night. I was sorry about the baby shower, but I'd gotten things as ready as I could get them. I was sorry I hadn't gotten to have a conference with Mr. Cataliades to get everything straight in my head, all this new information I'd hardly had time to assimilate. I was glad I'd given the money to Sam, and sorry I couldn't have been frank with him about why it needed to be done this very day. I hoped if I died, Jason would move back into the old house, that he would marry Michelle, that they would raise kids there. My mother, Michelle with two L's, had been completely different from Jason's Michelle with one L, at least judging by my childhood memory of her, but they were alike in loving Jason. I was sorry I hadn't told him I loved him the last time we'd spoken. I was sorry about a lot of things. My mistakes and offenses crowded around me. Eric drifted over and turned me on the stool so he could put his arms around me.
"I wish you didn't have to be here,"
he said. That was all the conversation we could have, with Jock in earshot. I leaned against Eric's cool body, my head resting on his silent chest. I might not ever get to do this again. Pam came to sit by Emmanuel. Thalia scowled, which was her fallback expression, and turned her back on all of us. Indira sat with her eyes shut, the graceful folds of her sari making her look like a statue at Pier 1. Heidi looked from one to the other of us very seriously, and her mouth became set in a grim line. If she was worrying about Victor, I figured she'd go stand by Jock, but I never saw her speak to him. Maxwell apparently heard a knock at the back door, inaudible to my human ears. He jetted away and returned to tell Eric that Bill and Bubba had arrived. They were staying in the office until the moment came. Very soon after that, I heard cars pull in front of the club.
"Showtime,"
Pam said, and for the first time that evening, she smiled. Chapter 15. Luis and Antonio came in first. They were clearly wary. It was like watching a cop show on television. They came inside in a rush, immediately separating to flank the door. I almost smiled, and Emmanuel actually grinned, which was not a good idea. Luckily, humans are the last creatures vampires will worry about when they're anticipating trouble. The two handsome vamps clad in jeans and t-shirts instead of leather loincloths, quickly searched the club, checking out places other vampires could hide. It would have been a severe breach of etiquette to demand body searches, but you could tell they were eyeballing each local vampire for guns or stakes. Maxwell had to give up his gun, which he did without a second's protest. He'd expected it. After a thorough scan of the premises and a bow to Eric, Luis stuck his head out to give the all clear. The rest of Victor's entourage entered in order of expendability. The married human couple he'd been with at Vampire's Kiss, Mark and Mindy, two young vampires whose names I never learned, Anna Lyudmila, who looked much better out of her fantasy bondage gear, and a vampire I'd never seen, an Asian guy with ivory skin and jet black hair pulled up on his head in a complicated knot. He would have looked great in traditional clothes, but instead he wore jeans and a black vest, no shirt or shoes.
Akiro, Heidi said in an awed whisper. She'd eased closer to me, and the tension had crept into her, too. You know him from Nevada?
Oh, yes, she said. I didn't know Victor had called for him. He's finally replaced Bruno, and Corinna, too. That's how good Akiro's reputation is. Since he was now officially second in command, it was okay for Akiro to be openly armed. He was carrying a sword, like one other Asian vampire I'd met. Come to think of it, she'd been a bodyguard, too. Akiro stood in the center of the room, conscious of all the eyes on him, his face cold and hard, and his eyes relentless. And then Victor made his entrance, resplendent in a white three-piece suit.
Good God Almighty, I said blankly, not daring to meet anyone's eyes.
Victor's dark curls were carefully arranged, and his pierced ear sported a big gold hoop earring. His shoes were beautifully black. Victor was a trip. It almost seemed a shame to try to destroy all that beauty, and I wished he weren't so determined to ruin our lives. I set my purse on the bar and unzipped it so I'd have quick access. Emmanuel slid off his stool and moved away to the wall, his eyes fixed on the newcomers. Heidi took his place while Victor and his party moved farther into the club. Though my eyes were fixed on Victor, I felt obliged to speak to Heidi, since I felt she'd perched beside me for a reason.
How's your son? I asked, like you do when you know someone had a loved one.
Eric has offered to let me bring him here, Heidi said, carefully keeping her eyes on the visitors.
That's very good news, I said, and I meant it. One more on our side.
In the meantime, the reception was moving slowly forward.
Victor, Eric said.
He moved front and center, a careful 2 yards away from the regent. He was smart enough not to give Victor a fulsome welcome, since that would be a huge tip that something bad was about to come down.
Welcome to Fantasia. We're glad to have the chance to entertain you.
Eric bowed. Akiro's face remained blank, as if Eric weren't there. Still standing and flanked by Luis and Antonio, Victor inclined his curly head.
Sheriff, I present my new right hand, Akiro,
he said with a flashing smile.
Akiro recently agreed to relocate from Nevada to Louisiana.
Eric said,
I welcome such a well-known vampire as Akiro to Louisiana. I'm sure you'll be a great addition to the region's staff.
Eric could give impassive as well as the next vampire. Akiro had to acknowledge the greeting of a sheriff, who was higher on the food chain, but you could tell he didn't want to. His bow was a millimeter too shallow. Vampires.
Great, I thought, very put out. Finally, Victor replaces his lieutenant and his best fighter, just at this moment. I guess this Akiro is a pretty good fighter, huh? I whispered to Heidi.
You could say that, Heidi said dryly, and she drifted forward to greet her regent. All Eric's vampires had to take turns offering obeisance. Jock, the newest member of Eric's staff, was last in line. You could tell he was ready to kiss Victor's ass if he got half a chance. Mindy, with ill-timed lust, gave Jock a hopeful look. She was so dumb, but that didn't mean she ought to die. I wondered if I could get her to make a trip to the women's room before the time came. No. Unless it was her idea, such a maneuver would be a red flag. I looked at the newcomers and tried to brace myself for what was to come. This was particularly horrible. This waiting, this planning, knowing I was about to do my best to kill the people in front of me. I was looking into their eyes and hoping they would die in the next hour. Was this how soldiers felt? I wasn't as wired as I thought I'd be. I was suspended in an eerie calm, perhaps because now that Victor had arrived, nothing could stop what was going to happen. When Victor indicated he was satisfied with his greeting by taking the central chair, Eric told Jacques to bring drinks all around. The out-of-town vamps all waited for Luis to drink from a glass he picked from the tray at random. After Luis survived for several minutes, all the newcomers selected glasses, and one by one, they all took sips. The atmosphere grew much easier after that because the drinks were absolutely kosher, warmed synthetic blood, a premium brand.
You stick to the letter of the law here at Fangtasia, Victor observed.
He smiled at Eric. Mindy was between them, and she was leaning on Victor's shoulder, her own Diet Coke with rum in front of her. Her husband, Mark, on Victor's left, didn't seem to feel well. His color was bad, and he seemed listless. When I saw the fang marks on his neck, I wondered if Victor had overindulged. Mindy didn't seem worried.
Yes, Regent,
Eric said. He smiled back, just as sincerely, and he didn't elaborate.
Your beautiful wife
is present, of course, Eric said.
What would the evening be without her?
Eric waved me forward, and Victor raised his drink to me in appreciation of my appearance. I managed to look pleased. Victor, I said, we're so glad you could come tonight. I didn't try to summon more than pleased. Victor wouldn't expect me to be as good at concealing my feelings as Eric was, and I wasn't going to give him cause to think any different. Of course, Eric hadn't wanted me to be there. He'd made it plain that a frail human should not be around when vampires were fighting. In theory, I agreed. I would much rather have been at home, but I would have worried every second. The clincher in my argument was that Victor would definitely go on the alert if I were conspicuous by my absence, which would have been a clear signal that Eric was about to spring something. Eric couldn't deny that when I'd made the point at our meeting. Akiro positioned himself behind Victor's chair. Awkward. I was trying to think what I could do about that. Pam was behind Eric's chair. When Eric beckoned to me, I smiled and went to join him, my purse over my shoulder. Colton and Audrina were blending into the background by carrying trays of drinks around the club. To my astonishment, Heidi went down on one knee by my chair, her posture indicating alert attention. Eric glanced at her, but didn't comment. Heidi was taking a stance as though Eric had ordered her to protect me during what might be a touchy visit. I looked down at her, but she didn't meet my eyes. Yep, that was exactly what had happened. At least that was within the scope of normal and wouldn't necessarily make the visitors worried.
Bill,
Eric called.
We're ready.
And Bill emerged from the back hallway, smiling, a totally uncharacteristic broad grin, to stand with his arm outflung toward the hall, ta-da, to announce Bubba's entrance. And what an entrance it was. It put Victor's in the shade.
Oh my gosh,
I murmured. Bubba was wearing a red jumpsuit that someone had taken a bedazzler to. He had fake jewels and sequins everywhere, and his hair was styled in an amazing pompadour. He was wearing black boots and big rings. He was smiling that amazing lopsided smile that had made women